This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. By now, everyone's heard of the housing bubble that burst in the late 2000s, sparking a deep recession. But in the legal community, there's been worry for years about a so-called lawyer bubble, with law firms expanding and hiring rapidly and ever-rising enrollments at the nation's law schools, to the point where in 2010, the number of people entering law school was at an all-time high. But now, as those students hit the job market, it appears this bubble too has burst, and firms have cut back their hiring. Among those who graduated with that Juris Doctorate last year, just a little more than half captured stable jobs in the law field, and nearly a third of the rest are classified as underemployed. And young adults have taken notice. Student applications to law school are almost half what they were 10 years ago. Enrollment has plummeted as well, more than 23% in the past few years. So now law schools are searching for ways to pick up the pieces. Some look to increase practical experience and specialization for better job placement, while others consider new programs that allow you to graduate in 2 years instead of three to help reduce student debt. But the big question remains unanswered. Is the drop in law school enrollment an overreaction to a bump in the road, or is the law profession itself in the midst of a dramatic restructuring? Today in The Exchange, the lackluster law economy. Let's hear from you. If you work in the legal field, are you seeing this contraction or not? And why do you think law schools today are struggling to attract students? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page if you like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. With me in studio is John Broderick, Dean of the UNH School of Law, former Chief Justice of the New Hampshire State Supreme Court. And Dean Broderick, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Rob Miller, partner and management committee member at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green in Manchester, author of several books, including Law School Confidential. Rob's firm also has offices in Concord, Hanover, and Boston. And Rob Miller, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Great to be here with you, Laura.
And joining us from the Chicago area is Steve Harper. He's an adjunct professor at Northwestern University, author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Steve was formerly a 30-year partner at Kirkland & Ellis, a law firm based in Chicago. And Steve Harper, really a pleasure having you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Well, gentlemen, I want to hear from all of you on this. I'll start with you, Dean Broderick. No matter how you slice and dice these numbers, they look pretty grim for law schools. What's going on?
Well, I think a lot of things are happening, Laura. Law school applications are down, I think principally because the economy has been in a funk for the last 5 or 6 years. I think the legal marketplace is transforming itself largely because of the economy, principally, I think, also because of technology. And there was a time when lawyers were the gatekeeper to any legal knowledge. And as we know, we can go on the computer, you and I, in the next half hour, get a lot of legal information. We might not analyze it properly, but we have access to it. So lawyers aren't as indispensable on the front end as they used to be.
Wow. We'll talk about that transformation for sure this hour. So what you're saying, Dean Broderick, is as the legal profession is transformed, it kind of makes sense that fewer people are going to law school.
Well, I think I don't think it's a permanent situation, Laura. When I got out of law school 100 years ago, people said at the time, don't become an engineer. There are no jobs for engineers.
Wow, and today it's all become an engineer.
Exactly. So lawyers are going through what I think is the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution. Nobody knows where the movie's going to end. It's a very transformative time, but frankly, people went to law school in 1935 in the Great Depression, when I'm sure there were very few jobs. By 1955, they were probably delighted they went. Lawyering will look and be different in the 21st century, but it won't go out of business.
Wow. Steve Harper, what do you think? Lawyers are going through the Industrial Revolution.
Well, I agree with the dean's comment that we're going through a dramatic change. In fact, it's sort of ironic. Just this morning, I downloaded the most recent. It came out this morning, actually, the Hildebrandt and Citibank do a combined report every year on the state of the legal profession, and they have said essentially the market that existed, and they're focused more in bigger law firms, which is a different market from what Rob's going to talk about for sure. And it's not just the law school market, but what's happening at the big firms often trickles down to the rest of the profession, because that's where the money is the biggest, and that's where most graduates of major law schools want to start their careers. The times prior to 2007, according to the Citibank report, are never coming back. So there is a dramatic shift underway. I do agree we're always going to need lawyers. We're certainly the bulwark of a civilized society. And one of the ironies, of course, and the dean knows this all too well from his time on the Legal Services Corporation and his commitment to trying to diversify and provide representation to those who can't get it, we have a very dysfunctional market in the sense that we've got lots of graduates who can't get jobs that pay enough to pay off their student loans, but we have vast segments of our society that are going unserved, unrepresented.
Yeah, so there's a real disconnect there.
It's an embarrassment, really.
Well, and Rob, I want to ask you, so picking up on what the other two gentlemen have said, what happened to the jobs? Because I remember graduating from college, this is in the mid-80s, and, those fellow students who went on to law school, everybody thought, wow, they're all set. They are not going to have any problem.
Well, it is, as Dean Broderick said, driven largely by the economy. I came out of law school during the dot-com boom, and everybody was really busy. And the more that clients were driving mergers and acquisitions and asset purchases and were, active in their business growth, the more they needed lawyers to do things quickly and to attend to those needs. As the economy dried up and at what we call the dot bomb occurred, where the technology sector just exploded, you saw a lot of firms that were what we used to call irrationally exuberant about how many people they hired in years where lawyers would or firms would increase their lawyer count by 100 or 150 lawyers a year. There wasn't work for those people anymore, and that has sort of been the trend over the last, 5 or 6 years at least in our neck of the woods up here.
Yeah. So you talked, Dean Broderick, about the Internet, and you can get some legal advice, some documents online. Talk a little bit more about that. You seem to have a little caveat there that, maybe we don't interpret it as well as we should, but it's there. How is that affecting the legal profession?
Well, if you have my handyman skills, Laura, I can buy all the Home Depot booklets I want, but I still couldn't put the vanity together. And the law business is somewhat like that. Lawyers really add value. The challenge, as I think Steve would know, is that the value they add is often more expensive than people can afford. And so the legal profession, I think, needs to come to terms with the fact that it is out of the reach, probably, of half the American people. They can't afford the lawyers.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and so that's true of small businesses. I think technology actually will help us, in time, get the cost under control. There are some law firms now that have been formed that are virtual law firms, so in that way they're lowering their overhead and increasing their reach. The last thing I'd like to say is something Steve said, which I agree with, which is there are hundreds of millions of dollars that are available for legal services, but people can't afford the full cost of a lawyer. So in New Hampshire and other states, we've gone to unbundled delivery of legal services to try to make legal services available, helping clients, helping courts, and helping lawyers themselves. So it's going to require a lot of innovation, but as Steve said, good lawyers will always be in short supply. And so I'm not discouraged by it. But I am focused on it, obviously.
Yeah. What do you think, Rob? I know you want to jump in there.
Yeah, I think a lot of the change that we've seen in the last decade is really driven by what clients are asking us to do. Back in the boom times when people were looking to accomplish things quickly and move on to the next thing because the economy was so white hot, there was less attention to efficiency and how many people were working on a project at a given time. It was more about speed and getting things done and moving on to the next deal. Now, I think what we're seeing is, clients that are coming to us with very specific problems, looking for us to solve those problems efficiently and practically, and to really look at things from a common sense approach. you know, not to over-lawyer things, not to...
over-lawyer things. What does that mean?
Yeah, over-lawyering is a term in the industry where, you know, you try to attend to every possible contingency, every risk, no matter how remote. And clients don't want that anymore. They want you to just look at a situation and say, okay, take care of this for me efficiently, practically, and, you know, cover my risk of, you know, what is reasonable to expect.
So you have to do a risk assessment there.
That's what we do. That's what we do as lawyers. We try and protect our clients from risk.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page if you like. If you're involved in the legal field, are you seeing this restructuring, this contraction, or not? And also, why do you think law schools today have a hard time attracting students? Enrollments are way down, as we're hearing. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Steve Harper, is this a cyclical market correction that you might expect, you know, in any type of business, or is this a long-term structural shift, the Industrial Revolution that Dean Broderick talked about?
I think it's long-term, and I think, you know, there's an elephant in the room, too, that we haven't really approached yet, but it's really relevant to people who are thinking about going to law school and even to some degree to students who are in law school now, and that is, it's certainly true that enrollments are down somewhat, but they're not nearly down as dramatically as applications are down. And so what's been happening, and this is a function of the kind of short-term thinking that the dean referred to, that sort of thinking, unfortunately, has really permeated the law school business model. Too many deans have decided that the most important thing they have to do is move up the U.S. News rankings. And the way to do that is to keep your, and in conjunction with that also, to in terms of a short-term business model, fill the classrooms with seats. And so one of the reasons that applications are down, but enrollments aren't down as much, is because law schools have increased dramatically their acceptance rates for students, notwithstanding the ongoing lawyer glut. You had a 75% chance of getting into a law school now, whereas 5 years ago it was 50%.
So it's a good time to apply if you're interested. I'm going to let you finish up, Steve, after a short break. We'll be right back. And after that break, we'll also start taking your calls. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR sustaining members support NHPR the same way you listen to it all year long. Become a sustainer with a monthly payment through your bank account for as little as $5 or $10 per month. Sustaining members transforming the future of public radio at nhpr.org. More on why more young people are ruling against law school on the exchange, then attend on the Diane Rehm Show, Understanding How Unemployment Insurance Works. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Sunapee Cove Assisted Living on Lake Sunapee and George's Mill, the comprehensive service your loved one needs in scenic lakeside setting. Models open daily, sunapeecove.com. And Gibson's Bookstore in downtown Concord, welcoming Lynn Lyons January 23rd at 7 p.m., discussing Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. More at gibsonsbookstore.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, why law school enrollment is dropping, applications are way, way down, as we're hearing, and how the industry, the law profession itself, may be in the midst of its own industrial revolution, as one of our guests says. Join us with your questions and comments on this at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. With me in studio, John Broderick, Dean of the UNH School of Law, Rob Miller, partner at Shee & Finney Bass & Green, author of Law School Confidential, and from the Chicago area, Steve Harper, adjunct professor at Northwest University and author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. And Steve Harper, just before the break, you were making a point about the elephant in the room, you called it, and that's
right.
Those U.S. News and World Report rankings, how one small magazine has a giant influence on the legal profession and law schools. Go ahead, Stephen, and finish up that point, please.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I can give you kind of two ways to illustrate it that kind of make the point. Back in 2010, as recently as 2009, 2010, because the ABA allowed them to do it, law schools could report employment rates in excess of 90 to 94% overall. In other words, the overall employment rate, if you believe the number, for lawyers who were newly graduated from law school was something like 94% in 2009. That number was only possible because law schools were allowed to report and the ABA let them do it. Employed meant whether or not you were working as an associate in Rob's firm or as a clerk for the judge or as a greeter at Walmart.
You didn't have to say
Starbucks,
what kind of employment.
Full-time, part-time, long-term. It didn't matter if it required a JD. So one of the reasons that applications are down now, frankly, I think, is because over the last couple of years, the ABA at long last has finally imposed some transparency. And what prospective students are now learning, they're learning two things. Number one, the U.S. news methodology is really stupid, and we could spend 3 hours talking about the stupidity of the U.S. news methodology, and I don't think anybody in this discussion would disagree with it by the time we were done. But the transparency that has resulted from the new requirements, for example, about 56% overall, only 56% of the graduates of 2012 found long-term, full-time jobs defined as lasting more than a year that required a JD.
So that means about half of them have
precisely
not found legal jobs.
Precisely. And meanwhile, then if you turn to the other side of the equation, which is the law school business model, tuition has continued to rise dramatically. Law school tuition has doubled overall every 10 years since 1985. Well, I guarantee you inflation hasn't proceeded at that pace. And even during the Great Recession, law school tuition has continued to increase for the vast, vast majority of law schools throughout the country. So what you wind up having is this situation where students have figured out that 85% of today's graduates are coming out of law school with law school debt that exceeds $100,000.
Wow.
Well, that's a home mortgage without a house. So some of the reason that there's a drop in applications is because I think students are figuring that out.
Let's go to our listeners, gentlemen, and then a lot more questions. Again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We want your questions, comments, personal experiences on this issue that we're talking about, the decline in law school applications and enrollments, and a contraction in the law profession itself. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Paula is up first from Concord. Hi, Paula. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I am actually calling from Durham, New Hampshire. I'm the pre-law advisor at the University of New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Paula.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Paula. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sure. My comment is that I agree with all the things your speakers are mentioning for the decline in applications. I hear it all the time with undergraduates. Too much money. I'm not sure I'm going to get a job. But what I'm seeing now is the end of the bubble. I've got increased interest in students for law school, and I'm seeing higher quality students. So while the quantity may be down, I'm seeing a vast increase in the GPAs and the interest level. So you're getting better students, and I hope that the dean can concur with me on that.
Well, Paula, what do you say to those students, though, who come to you and say, you know, I'm not really sure about this. I mean, it's really expensive, and the hiring once I'm done doesn't look too good.
I really encourage them to do their homework, to speak with young lawyers, recent graduates, or those students who are now in law school. And I also ask them why they want to go, what their personal goals are. Many of them now are not interested in being corporate lawyers. They want to either be entrepreneurs and want to have that degree behind them so that they can be their own lawyer, or do work with nonprofits and other organizations. So they see different things that they can do with the JD. So a lot of the conversation has to do with, what are you going to do with this degree once you get that? And that's a conversation students didn't want 10 years ago. They knew it was the ticket to success 10 years ago, but now they think, well, I have to know where I'm going with this to invest.
So this restructuring that we're seeing, Paula, has, you know, made students perhaps a little more thoughtful about why they want to go. It's not just an automatic punch card to success.
Exactly. I would say much more thoughtful, and it's not the knee-jerk reaction. What else am I going to do with this degree in humanities history? Now it's, I want to be a lawyer so badly, I don't care what the statistics say, I have the drive, and I can be the exception to the rule.
Okay, Paula, great to hear from you. What do you think, Dean Broderick?
Well, I agree with what Paula said. Our classes are smaller at the law school. There's no question. That's true in most law schools around the country. the quality of the student at the law school has risen. The best two classes in the 40-year history of our law school are the last two
classes. When you say best two, how do you assess that?
In terms of GPA and LSAT scores, quantitatively the best we've ever seen. I think what gets lost in the discussion oftentimes is this near-term sense that if it doesn't pay off in 24 months after graduation, why bother? I've been a lawyer and a judge, Laura, in New Hampshire for almost 40 years. I'm now a dean of a law school. None of those things would have been possible without my investment in my legal education and the opportunities I've had to help people in need and to be engaged and involved in my community and my state most likely would not have happened without that degree. So I encourage people to have the big picture long-term sense and to understand that you can do more with a law degree than simply join a big law firm.
All right. I want to ask you, Rob, a question about the cost that Steve mentioned earlier, but also go back to our listeners. Thanks for that call, Paula. And to Ted waiting in Portsmouth. Hey, Ted, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple of points. I have to disagree with Paula that she's saying that the end of the bubble is near. I don't think so. And I'd like your guest to address the fact that, you know, is there too many law schools in general? How many people are they putting out per year graduating? And, does it take, really 3 years? Should you have to go 3 years to get a law degree? And lastly, the LSAT. I mean, is that an accurate measure? Can we do away with that and actually still be fine getting people into law school? I'll take my comments offline. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Ted. And I think I'll turn to you, Steve Harper, for the first part, since you are the author of Law School. Oh, no, that's Rob Miller, Law School Confidential. You're the author of The Lawyer Bubble. But to you, Steve Harper, his question about do you have to do it in 3 years? Now, as I understand, where you work, Northwestern University, they offer students the opportunity to do it in two.
Well, there's several law schools have what they call accelerated programs. Let me answer two of the factual questions, though, that the caller had. We, last year in 2012, or the most recent number we have, 2012, graduated 46,000 new lawyers. That's a record. We're going to set another record for 2013. And some of that is a function of undergraduates who piled into law schools as the Great Recession was beginning because it looked like it was a place that they could wait out a tough economy for 3 years. But the answer to the question is everyone who's looked at it, everybody who has looked at the numbers has said, look, we're generating roughly twice as many lawyers every year, taking into account attrition and everything else, as there are legal jobs, and that's a situation that's likely to continue well into the next decade. So the answer is I agree with the caller that the lawyer, we're not done at all in terms of this problem. We're not seeing the light. I don't know what's at the end of the tunnel or what we're seeing, but it's not the light. As far as the LSAT, that's sort of ironic in a way. Of course, every law school in the country, I think, uses it, but LSAC itself has done correlation analyses between LSATs and first-year grades and found the correlation is roughly 0.4, which for statisticians out there is like saying they can explain 16% of the of what goes on by reference to an LSAT if you want to compare that to, say, to as a predictor of first-year grades. So I've always thought it was kind of silly that we put so much stock in it. But in terms of your other question, which is the two versus 3 years, personally, and it'd be interesting to hear what Rob and the dean have to say. I thought everything, and most people, I think, would tell you, most lawyers would tell you, that everything that they really needed to know to practice law, they could get in 2 years. Clarence Darrow went to law school for 1 year and then did an internship for a year under the tutelage of an apprenticeship, I should say, of a practicing lawyer. The issue, I suppose, though, is not really is 3 years a good idea. The issue is at what cost? What's the added value? And so what you're seeing now, and I think it's far superior to the notion of cramming 2 years of 3 years of law school into two calendar years at the same price, which makes no sense to me at all, is an increase on apprenticeships and internships and experiential learning in the third year so that these kids that are coming out of law school, even if they can't get a job, whether it's for a firm or a public interest group or the government, at least they have the beginnings of the wherewithal to try to cobble together a living with some basic skills. I think that's probably directionally where most law schools are likely to go.
Rob Miller, what about you? What do you think about Ted's comment? Are there too many law schools?
It's really hard to say. I think the real question is, what are people doing with their law degrees when they're coming out? I want to go back to something Paula said. And I wrote a note to myself as she was speaking, following up on something Dean Broderick said also, that, you know, it isn't necessarily the case that you go to law school to be a lawyer. one of the things I talk about in my book is that law school teaches you how to think. It teaches you how to think in a totally different way than most other graduate programs. It forces you to really analyze issues, to dig down and look at root causes, and you know, once you come out of that experience, you can do all kinds of things with a law degree. So I think it's important to remember that, yes, you can go and, you know, become a member of a law firm or be an in-house counsel or whatever, but some of the happiest lawyers I know aren't practicing law at all. They're entrepreneurs. They've started their own businesses. They're writers. They work in journalism. You know, any number of things that require you to think critically. So are there too many law schools? It depends really on what people want to do with their law degree when they come out. Are there too many law schools for the number of law firm jobs? Certainly seems that way based on everything we've talked about so far.
So are some of them going to have to close their doors?
That's really hard to tell, you know.
I mean, I've read about cutbacks, including at Vermont Law.
It depends on how law schools adjust to the needs of the marketplace. One thing that we haven't talked about yet that I think we should is the Webster Scholars Program at UNH Law, which is something that I can talk about personally, having hired several people out of that program. You know, UNH Law started this program that is very much like the model Steve was talking about, an apprenticeship sort of practicum model. Where I went to school at the University of Pennsylvania, it was very sort of philosophical approach to the law. And what UNH Law is doing through their Webster Scholars Program is creating a very practical, hands-on program where law students get into this program and they learn the various subjects that law school teaches through a practicum, so that it tethers their experience to the ground and makes it real. And so when these kids are coming out of that program, they're what they call client ready, meaning they've had a lot of the experiences that they need to jump right into real practice and know what they're doing.
If that's what they want to do.
If that's
what
they want to do.
As you said, a lot
of
people don't use that degree for specific lawyering.
But I'll tell you, as a hiring partner, that's one of the things that we have really appreciated and has made us look at UNH Law a lot more for the people that we hire.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Ted, thanks a lot for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's a Facebook comment that came in from Emily. She says, I've read that the Coalition of Concerned Colleagues idea of reducing law school from 3 to 2 years would make legal education less expensive and time-consuming. But, Emily says, if there are already too many lawyers who cannot pay their debts, then lowering the bill for newcomers will encourage more to join the profession and thus make the problems of the existing underemployed worse. Emily asks, shouldn't we just let the bubble burst and go through the normal cycle of the economy? Emily, it's a great thought. Dean Broderick, I'll throw that to you first.
Well, the answer is no one knows. The answer is no one knows. Everyone's trying to adjust to a very different matrix than we've seen in the past. Some people want a two-year law program, Laura. It's 6 semesters crammed into 2 years, no summer work, because they have something they want to do in their life and they want to use their degree. So who am I to judge? Other people believe that 3 years of law school is important. At UNH, for example, about 75% of our students spend either a semester or an entire year out in the real world, in the public sector or the private sector. The Daniel Webster Scholar Program that Rob Miller talked to you about is getting national attention as perhaps a future model of American legal education. What's happened, and Steve would know this too, when I started practicing law, the law firms, the large firms had a pyramid model. So the people at the bottom of the pyramid were the new associates, The big firms billed them out at a pretty good rate, and clients paid for them. Suddenly the client said, we're not paying for those young people. We want law schools to train them. And law firms started pushing back on law schools, saying, why don't you train them better so they can start billing for their time when they leave? Our law school, since it was founded 40 years ago, Laura, has been doing that from day one, and we're getting better at it all the time. And what law firms want and what clients need are lawyers who are client ready. And we have devoted a lot of our energy to that. I'm very proud of what we've done at the law school.
Emily, thanks a lot for that comment. Again, the number on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Steve Harper, I want to return to something that Dean Broderick said earlier and talk to all of you about it. He said legal services, lawyering, if we can call it that, is out of reach financially for about half of the American public. What do you think you and others in this profession should do about that?
Well, there's an interesting, you know, we talk about, and this really goes to your last caller as well, it's not a matter of do we have too many law schools. We're still adding law schools. We've added a dozen law schools in the last 12 years, which is ridiculous, and they're more in the pipeline. And the reason that happens, and this really does go to the question you asked, it has to do with the other elephant in the room that we haven't talked about, which is how this is all funded. And the way it's all funded is with student loans. It's very, very easy to get a federally backed student loan, which, don't get me wrong, I could not have gone to college or law school without federally insured student loans. The problem is that there is a fundamental disconnect because once the law school receives the student's tuition payment, the law school has no financial skin in the game with respect to the financial consequences for that student. So if the student can't get a job that pays what's necessary. Whoop. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Steve. You're still there.
Oh, sorry. If a student can't get a job that is sufficient to cover the cost of repaying that debt and winds up defaulting and so on and so forth, two things happen. Number one, it's debt that's not dischargeable in bankruptcy, so you live with it the rest of your life. And number two, the federal government is going to stand behind it. So there's never any risk. There's never any connection to a market consequence in terms of the law schools, which is an important factor in all this because you don't really have the normal market constraints that you would have if the law school were truly a business and forced to respond to business needs. Now, what does that mean in terms of serving the underserved population? Well, it becomes a kind of vicious circle because you got to figure out a way in an era where, as the dean knows really well, legal services corporation and other public types of funding. We're just not doing that. We've been cutting dramatically.
Yeah, you got to make money to pay back that debt. We'll follow up after a super short break. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, answering your questions about how unemployment insurance works. Then award-winning author Chang-Rae Lee on his provocative fictional portrait of America's future. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters, online at justcallheritage.com. And Littleton Regional Healthcare, sending best wishes for a happy holiday season for a healthy new year, littletonhealthcare.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we talk with Commissioner Chris Clement of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation about roads and bridge repair. Email us your thoughts in advance if you'd like. Exchange at nhpr.org is the email address to email us your questions for Christopher Clement before the program. You can also comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can join us now with a phone call if you'd like, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Steve Harper, just before the break, you were talking about, you know, how lawyering, as Dean Broderick says, is out of reach financially for many, many Americans. You said part of the problem is lawyers are trying to just make money so they can repay their debt. So go ahead, finish that up for us, if you could, please.
Well, that was sort of the point, which is that, you know, we talked earlier about how tuition has continued to rise dramatically. You know, back when I was in law school, medical school was way more expensive than law school. those lines crossed a long time ago. So law school has now become, on a tuition, annual tuition basis, more expensive than medical school in most places, which makes really very little economic sense if you're looking at a cost-based justification for the price of what you're getting. And so, you know, at the end of the day, as I mentioned before, if you've got 85% of today's graduates coming out of law school with more than $100,000 in student debt, well, tell me what job you're going to get. You got to get a job in order to start paying that stuff off, because you can never get rid of that debt. You can, as I said, you can't discharge it in bankruptcy. Income-based repayment is a new, sort of relatively new phenomenon, but that's got all sorts of caveats associated with it, and isn't going to help a lot of people that are already, you know, under tremendous burdens relating to all this stuff. So try to factor in all that then. Okay, fine. We should definitely help people that can't afford legal services, but who's going to do it? It's certainly hard to ask the kids that are coming out of law school with that kind of debt to say, well, you know, tighten your belt a little more, suck it up, and you know, go work for $12 an hour or $20 an hour or for nothing or whatever, when we don't, as a society, have a willingness to, in a fundamental way, fund the programs that would, you know, provide decent jobs for those people.
Wow. So, again, another disconnect, as Dean Broderick said earlier. Rob Miller, do you want to jump in there?
Well, I think it's important for people listening to get a little bit of sort of practical advice about how to engage the legal profession, right? You know, for people listening out there who have a need for legal services, let's start first on the corporate side or with litigation. You know, when they engage a law firm, they ought to ask some hard questions on the intake. How are you going to staff my case? How many people are going to work on it? Who am I going to speak to when I call and need my questions answered? What is the budget going to look like? And what is the time frame going to look like? What's the timetable for getting my problem solved? And put those hard questions to the lawyer that is speaking with you on your intake. And make sure you're happy with the answers.
Yeah, it's tough, though, because when you need a lawyer, it's often in a crisis.
Well, in some cases, but not always. Not always. And so, you know, it's important for people to be good consumers of legal services on the first hand and ask those hard questions, and make sure they're happy with the answers. And if they're not, be aware of the situation that exists in the marketplace right now and shop around until you find somebody who you are happy with, who is going to look at your problem practically and handle it that way.
So a good time to buy, so to speak.
Exactly.
Here's an email that just came in from Kyle, who says, I have quite a few friends under the age of 30 who have gone for a law degree and have had a very hard time finding a job, many of which have resorted to either trying to start their own firms, which is hard when you have debt, or working jobs where their colleagues do not have a law degree. Kyle says, as an engineer, I feel like these well-learned people could have easily done an engineering degree, but were lured into law by media, their family, and society's idea of what a lawyer is. Kyle, thanks a lot for those thoughts. What do you think, Dean Broderick?
Well, I plead guilty for being lured into law. It's been the most rewarding career I could have imagined.
Yeah, but it was different when you went into it.
It wasn't, Laura, in a sense. Look, every period has its own challenges. If I were graduated from college today, I would have a different formula to look at, but I would become a lawyer in a heartbeat. Why? Because I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to be a lawyer for a lifetime. Again, I think the legal profession and law schools and the American Bar Association and the student loan programs need to have a summit meeting. Trust me, I believe that. We need to make the product more affordable for more people. The economy, however, if it were booming today, if this were 1996, we probably wouldn't be having this show. So a lot of it is economy-driven. I don't believe that it's always going to be like this, but I do believe that change is here. Yesterday is not returning, and we need to work cooperatively and collaboratively and thoughtfully to find the answer. And so Steve is right about much of what he says, but I don't think that's where the movie will end. And that's not what I'm doing at the law school. So I think all of us have to continue to rethink it, make the product more accessible and affordable, but provide quality. Those are real challenges. And right now, a lot of focus is on law. But it won't always be there, and we will work through it. I'm confident we will.
Even if the cost were brought down to a point, Dean Broderick, where law school was more affordable, if there aren't the jobs out there, what's the incentive to go to law school?
Well, if the jobs were going to be like this, Laura, to the horizon, we should all buy canned goods and lock ourselves in our basement. It's not always going to be like this. By the way, I want to mention this to you as well. The sticker price of a law school education, particularly now, is not paid for by many students. In many ways, this is not a bad time to go to law school because you'll get a pretty good bargain at most law schools you apply to. So whatever the sticker price is, like buying a new car, you shouldn't assume you're going to pay 100% of it because there's a lot of scholarship money available in addition to the student loan money. But I'm not one of those people, Laura, that believes that because it's tough now, it's going to be tough 20 years from now. I don't think that's true.
So scholarships, not loans, because we talked about the problem of debt. You know, loans are great to help pay for it, but then, oops, you graduate and
there are a number of students, for example, at our law school who are going to law school for less money than I went, and I paid $3,400 a year. They're paying $0. They're on full ride at the law school. We have established, as you know, the Rudman Center at the law school, and the goal there is to have students come in as Rudman Fellows who will go through law school for zero tuition in exchange for 3 years of public service. And so I think there are ways to deal with it. But longer term, we have to have a larger discussion about how we deal with the legal profession and its future.
All right,
no question, that needs to happen.
Let's take another call if we could. And this is Tony calling in from Epsom. Hi, Tony. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Laura. And I want to say hello to my good friend and my I have all the admiration for Chief Broderick. He has done wonders for the law school. I have a couple of points. Since Chief's arrival at the law school, he has implemented great improvements. And there was a discussion about rigging numbers of the graduates who find positions in the field. Franklin Peters or currently UNH Law is immune to that. We do not do that, period, paragraph, and that's the end of that story. The second part is Franklin Pierce, or current UNH Law, has its mission not simply to pump out lawyers to be able to litigate, to be able to sue and be sued and defense, but to introduce people into public service, into mediation, alternative dispute resolution, regulations, and all sorts of things, which law is a very useful training platform because of the critical thinking skill. Finally, the in the old days, and I don't want to age myself or Chief Broderick, he will always be Chief Broderick to me. I spent $6,500 a year for my law school education. And back then it was more difficult. It was stove piping where we had to learn everything to be the current day. And the trend that I see today is that the students are not being given the elementary tools, and therefore the students that are coming out or the graduates that are coming out are far from mission ready for anything else. And even on the Daniel Webster program, where you get an internship, let's say at the AG's office, Department of Environmental Services, these kids are locked up in a basement organizing files.
Okay, and Tony, I'm going to let you go because that's a lot of questions, and I do want to hear from our guests on this. To his last point, I think, Steve Harper, feeling like students today are not given the fundamental tools, not mission ready, as Tony says. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I don't think the first 2 years of law school has changed dramatically over the last 50 or 100 years in terms of the basic first-year course. Rob referred to it as thinking like a lawyer. I think that's exactly right, and I don't have any criticism of it, frankly. The first year of law school is a unique experience that is not like anything else that anyone has ever, who's been in school, has ever had before, and I think that's a necessary thing to happen. Second year tends to be more substantive, and I think law schools, actually, I'm not sure I agree with the caller. I think law schools have increasingly moved their third year towards more experiential kinds of programs, and I think in that sense they're more mission ready certainly than I was when I came out of Harvard, 35 years ago. The other thing I did want to mention too, and this is a response to Kyle, your earlier caller, I think he's exactly right. I started teaching an undergraduate course 7 years ago, precisely because I do believe that part of the fault for what has happened here lies with students who have unrealistic expectations of what being a lawyer is going to be. You know, they watch the media images, they want to be Atticus Finch, or they want to be Alicia Florrick on The Good Wife. Well, this is just true. I encounter these kids. They're in my advanced undergraduate seminar at Northwestern that I've been teaching for the last, as I say, 7 years, which predated the Great Recession, and by a year or two. And you know, part of what we do is, and I also agree with the dean, I cannot imagine anything else that I could have done with my life that it would have been more rewarding professionally or personally. Or I needed to be a lawyer in the same way that it sounds like he did.
Steve,
and I can't imagine.
Can I jump in and ask you a quick question? Because you piqued my interest there. You were responding to what Kyle said. He felt like, you know, some of his friends were lured into law by media and society's idea of what a lawyer is. And you alluded to that. Shouldn't you, let me just ask you the contrarian view, shouldn't you be grateful that some of these TV shows, exaggerated though they may be, get young people interested in your venerable profession?
No, and I'll tell you why.
No, okay.
Because the law, unfortunately, is one of those professions where we have higher rates of career dissatisfaction, depression, substance abuse, and everything else, because for most kids that come out of law school, not for the dean, not for me, and probably not for Rob, but for most people who come out of law school, the reality does not match their expectations.
I see.
And when you have that kind of a disconnect, it's a prescription for disaster. In 2007, in October 2007, the ABA, in its last national survey of lawyers, found that 6 out of 10 attorneys, and this is prior to the Great Recession now, 6 out of 10 attorneys who had been practicing 10 years or more affirmatively counseled young people to stay away from law school. And I think that's just tragic. And so I think the opposite's true. I think what people need to do who are thinking about going to law school is scrutinize very closely why it is they want to go and what is it they're responding to. We all go through life with what psychologists call confirmation bias. We want to believe that our view of the world is correct, and we embrace images and data that confirm that, and we reject data that is contrary to that worldview. And what I do in 10 weeks of reality therapy at Northwestern, and I wish every student could go through it, because I do it, I think, from a very positive and enthusiastic point about the profession, is say, look, just take a hard look at yourself. Take a hard look at, you're not going to be Alicia Florrick. You're not going to be Clarence Darrow. Or you might be, but the odds are that you won't be, because this is what most lawyers do for a living. This is how they work. This is the way they spend their days.
Reality therapy.
Yeah. Yep. 10 weeks.
You know, Rob, I'm interested because, again, you are involved in hiring at Sheehan Fenney Bass & Green. What do you see among young applicants? What do you tell them? It's very interesting to me what Steve Harper says.
Well, among applicants to our firm, we try, through our summer program to give people a very realistic look at what the experience working as a lawyer is like. We don't lock people in a basement and just put them on, you know, document review or research. We actually give them opportunities to get into court, give them opportunities to get to the deal table, to work on pieces of things, and to see life as it really is. The problem is, going back to the previous point, though, for many people that's too late, right? Because what you really need to do is, before you go to law school, to put yourself through, as Steve was saying, I totally agree with everything he said, a really rigorous self-analysis of, have you been seduced into thinking that law is something it's not?
So Paula, our earlier caller, who does that advice role at UNH.
And to students out there in college who are thinking about law school, you know, pick up Steve's book, pick up my book, pick up somebody else's book, talk to lawyers, talk to people in the profession, and get a really good sense. Don't be seduced by John Grisham or, you know, Atticus Finch or Law and Order. You know, you're not in court very often. You're not at the deal table all that much. A lot of the work is, you know, is in the back office, you know, working through papers and reading and researching. And, you know, that's the not sexy part that constitutes 90% of what we do. If you're interested in that and in being a problem solver, which I am, and I'm happy, you know, in my profession for that reason, then you're good. But if you don't have a realistic vision of what practicing law is really like, then you owe it to yourself to get that realistic view before you invest.
Before you enroll, it sounds like. Sometimes they don't get that view until they're actually enrolled and they've already spent, you know, who knows how many thousands
exactly
of dollars.
Exactly right. Before
I'd like them to do it before they submit an application fee.
Yeah. Maybe that should be part of the application, Steve, huh?
I'd love it.
Dean Broderick, I want to finish up with you. What's your prediction for the rest of this decade? You know, 2020 is not that far away. When do you expect the tide to turn, if at all? Or are we going to be seeing a completely different ball game in the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 years?
I think a couple of things will happen, Laura, just because of attrition. And that is to say, there have been fewer people applying to law school, as Steve pointed out. There are baby boomers like myself who are retiring from the practice of law. They will create a huge void in the practice.
So there will be some slots available.
Absolutely, there will be opportunities. I think lawyers will reorganize in some cases how they operate, lower overhead. I think law schools will continue to work with the ABA and others to try to lower costs or contain costs. But at the end of the day, as Steve and Rob have said, if you want to be a lawyer, that's what you want to do. I don't want to be the person on this end of the line saying, that's a foolish dream. I don't want to crush a dream. When I was in law school, probably 20% of the kids in my class, it was the fifth year of college, because mom and dad would either say Mary or Bob are unemployed, or they're going to say Mary and Bob are going to law school. So those students, I think, have dropped away. The people going to law school now seem much more focused and attentive to why they're there. I feel very good about the future.
All right. Well, we'll call you back in a couple of years and see how it's going. Dean Broderick, thank you very much for being here. That's John Broderick. He's Dean of UNH School of Law, former Chief Justice of the New Hampshire State Supreme Court. Steve Harper, it was great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Steve Harper, adjunct professor at Northwestern University and author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. And Rob Miller, it was nice to meet you. Thank you also.
Thank you, Laura.
Rob Miller, partner and management committee member at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, author of the book Law School Confidential. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire's Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement. He's been increasingly vocal about his belief that the department needs more money, adding he's revenue agnostic, meaning he doesn't care where it comes from. We'll examine the impact Clement says this fiscal struggle will have on our 10-year highway plan, from I-93 widening to red-listed bridges. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. New Hampshire weather partly to mostly sunny today. Highs lower 40s north, ranging lower 50s in southern parts of the state. Mostly cloudy tonight with rain, likely rain showers mixing with freezing rain after midnight in central and northern areas of the state. Lows tonight in the 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and hospice at HCS, hosting a yoga weekend January 25th and 28th in Keene with more than 50 yoga classes to benefit hospice. Online registration at hcsservices.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It is 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In 1935, in the midst of the Great Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt signed into law the Social Security Act. One provision of the new law was unemployment insurance, created to help stabilize the economy and